The Jewish Sabbath versus the Christian Sabbath, are they the same? This is part three of a study on the calendar, comparing the differences in concept between the Jewish calendar Sabbath and the old Hebrew calendar Sabbath. And we're also going to study the difference involved in the Christian calendar Sabbath. I'm hoping that this will serve as a primer course in calendar history. Now, it's not going to give exhaustive information, but hopefully it will give enough information, and more than what's been given in most cases, so that you can yourself find the door open to further study on your own, and hopefully more people on a scholarly level and people who perhaps have more ability than I do will look into this also, and we'll get some more people talking about it, looking into it, and teaching the truth about it. My own eyes were open to the truth about this a few years ago when I was given a tract by Pastor Curtis Ewing. Up to that time, I had been a Sabbath keeper, but I was keeping what I now consider as the wrong Sabbath. But I was convinced that Saturday was the Christian Sabbath at that point. And when I read Ewing's article, I realized almost immediately that I was going to have to re-evaluate my views. And after a little investigation, I came to realize that my information that I had been basing opinions on was lacking. I hadn't had sufficient data to make a correct judgment. So getting the new data from this tract and going on from there, that was the beginning of a transformation for me and my family from what I now believe was a Jewish Sabbath concept over to what I now think is a Christian Sabbath concept. And there is a difference. I'm grateful for that tract that Pastor Ewing wrote. It's called Israel's Calendar and the True Sabbath. Pastor Ewing's writings were themselves based on a earlier exposure that he had to another writing titled Sunday, the True Sabbath of God, written by Samuel Gamble back in 1900. And now I'm trying to pass this favor along by sharing this information, and we also are in the process of trying to come up with a tract on the subject that we can distribute. It's not an easy subject to cover adequately in a tract, and we're working on it. And I've been able to uncover, I think, a little bit more information, which I'd like to have end up in the tract as well. But hopefully that'll be available before too long. Last week I closed my sermon with a statement about the motive and purpose behind Israel's calendar and the laws and the Sabbaths concerning it. I said that Israel was not called to be religious. She was called to be ethical. And I pointed out that a system of religion is not the same as a system of godly ethics. Religion is usually about 90% superstition, but godly ethics are truth, their justice, their accuracy, and efficiency. Because the most truthful and accurate thing is the most efficient. In other words, it's a system which adheres to God's laws. God's laws do not program us to be religious, they program us to be correct. I believe that religion has been the downfall of Israel more than any other factor. Today we have religious men in the pulpits of America teaching destructive false doctrine, destroying the country with their religion. We have religious Jews, religious Masons, religious witches, religious humanists, religious Hindus, all permeating the higher offices in our land and in control of many of the large banks, and they too are destroying the country. And so in a word, religion is really destroying our civilization. Truth sets us free. Religion and superstition puts us in bondage. Jesus came to set us free with the truth. The foremost area where these truths have been centered and is most urgently needed is in the area of national economics. I know of no other area in more need of truth. The suppression of economic truth and the promulgation of economic lies is the main reason that the few rich, the elite men of our country, are able to deprive millions of Americans of their rightfully inherited freedoms. These men I'm referring to are religious. They have religious motive behind their plunder because they want to control. But they're not Christians. They're religious and they're not Christians. Now what they do is not taught in the Bible and it's not from Christ. As I pointed out in a study a few months ago, these anti-Christ religions have their own kind of Christ, but it's not the Christ of the Bible. It's not the Christ of the God of Israel. They have their own Christs, and so they can even use the word Christian if they want to and possibly do it accurately, but it's not the Christ of the Bible. There are different Christs, and I pointed that out some time ago. They have counterfeit Christs. And in the area of economics is where the calendar really comes into play. Last week I talked about motives behind Israel's calendar, and I explained that it was nothing other than an expression of economic truths designed to establish and keep God's blessings abundance in the land. Now, most people don't think of the calendar in terms of economics, but when you stop to really look at it, what more is concerned, what other subject would be more concerned about the calendar than economics? We base every economic thing we're involved in on the calendar. We have paydays, we have due dates of where we pay other people, we have calendars where we write down where the times that we go to work, the schedules of a job. Fiscal planning is all based on the calendar. Economics, nationally and locally and even in the family, is all based on the calendar. The prime or main use of a calendar is for economics, whether you've ever realized it or not. And I said that the Word of God doesn't indicate that the true worship of God is done in church or in a synagogue, nor is it done one way a week in any building. Rather, it's done daily in the marketplace where free men and women exchange the fruits of their labor in a fair and honest manner. That's where you really worship God. And Israel's laws forbade the taking of usury in any form, as well as the remaining of any debt for more than 6 years. It precluded that according to the laws. And so we read more about the calendar in Leviticus 25, starting in verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses in Mount Sinai, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When ye come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath unto the Lord. 6 years thou shalt sow thy field, and 6 years thou shalt prune thy vineyard, and gather in the fruit thereof. But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest unto the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. Thou shalt neither sow thy field nor prune thy vineyard. That which groweth of its own accord of thy harvest thou shalt not reap, neither gather the grapes of thy vine undressed, for it is a year of rest unto the Lord. And the Sabbath of the land shall be meat for you, for thee and for thy servant, and for thy maid, and for thy hired servant, and for thy stranger that sojourneth with thee, and for thy cattle, and for the beasts that are in thy field, shall all the increase thereof be meat. Now there you have a function of the calendar. Welfare, charity, taxes, inheritances, and debt release were all integral parts of the 50-year Jubilee cycle built into the calendar. These were functions of a civil law embraced in the calendar. The Jubilee is mentioned also in verses 8 through 10. And thou shalt number 7 Sabbaths of years unto thee, 7 times 7 years, and the space of the 7th Sabbath of years shall be unto thee 49 years. 7 Sabbaths of years amounts to 49 years. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the Day of Atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. And ye shall hallow the 50th year, and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. That's the inscription on our Liberty Bell. Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto the inhabitants thereof. And it shall be a jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family. Contrary to common thought today, Israel's Sabbaths were not intended to simply call people to meetings. They were instituted for mostly economic reasons, to prevent economic chaos and ensure the liberty and the abundance in the land spoken of here in chapter 25 of Leviticus, verse 10. If the people were deprived of God's laws in the marketplace, or if they were unable to practice these truths and justice in the marketplace, if they couldn't find what was called a perfect and just weight in the marketplace, then they as a people could not worship their God. It's as simple as that. You can't do it if you ignore that one way. All else is in vain if they don't worship Him in the marketplace. There's not a soul on this earth that's not affected by the marketplace. If the marketplace is corrupt, it affects everyone. If it's righteous, it affects everyone for good. And that truth is even more meaningful to us today as we look around at our evil marketplace right now. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Reading from verse 13. Thou shalt not have in thy bag diverse weights, a great and a small. Thou shalt not have in thy house diverse measures, a great and a small. But thou shalt have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure shalt thou have, that thy days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. For all that do such things, and all that do unrighteously, are an abomination unto the Lord thy God. Now part of having a just weight and a perfect balance is described in the laws regarding debt release and non-usury. In Proverbs 11, verse 1, it says that a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is His delight. Turn back to Leviticus 19. And reading from verse 35, ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meat yard, in weight, or in measure, just balances, just weight, a just ephah, and a just hin shall ye have. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. Therefore shall ye observe all my statutes and all my judgments and do them. I am the Lord. You see, that more than anything else defines true worship of God. It's not being religious, it's being ethical, it's being truthful. Without God's laws directing our economy in the land, especially in the government and in the marketplace, the true worship of God is impossible. As long as usurers are allowed to hold debts on people forever, the people will not be able to realize or even conceptualize the idea of economic sanity and stability. You're not even geared to thinking along those lines. The primary thought in most of our minds in a situation like this is survival. How to get your payment to the bank in time. You don't even have a time to think about God's laws. But you better take time. And Israel's calendar was a tool provided by God to keep Israel on an economically sane track. It puts God's laws in economics into practical, daily, monthly action in our land. And so we see the importance that this plays in the ordained Sabbath of God in Israel, in the national sense. Israel's calendar was a civil economic schedule, a tool of civil government, not a religious tool. Israel didn't need a calendar to tell them how to worship God on a one-day-a-week basis. You didn't need a calendar to say, well, this day you go to church or you go to synagogue or you go to a meeting and worship God. They didn't need a calendar for that. What they needed a calendar for was to help them worship God every day of the year. We've had it turned around backwards for so long. We've had it turned around the wrong way. We think that you go and sanctify a particular day and worship God on that day, and then you manage to eke out your living and live in the land and work amongst people all the other days, and that had nothing to do with God's laws. God ordered Israel to worship Him by obeying His laws and respecting Him every day of the year, not just one day out of seven. Going to church one day of the week doesn't constitute worship. At least it doesn't constitute the worship of Israel's God. Remember, Sabbaths were not days to worship anyway. They were days of rest. Sabbaths were not days to worship, they were days to rest. Now, you worship also in that manner, but that isn't what made them different from other days of the week. They weren't different in that you worship on them. They were different in that you rest on them. And the feasts of the Old Covenant were also designated on this calendar of Israel. And they were days that were designated to offer sacrifices according to that Old Covenant law, and to rejoice in the Lord's blessings for having obeyed the law of the Lord. They were also days to collect tithes for national and local treasuries, and things of that nature. These rituals, these feasts, and these Sabbaths were not religious in nature. They were civil rituals, designed to support the Levitical priesthood, which was the government, and to keep Israel in mind of the fact that all blessings did come from God. His greatest blessing to them was, of course, His law, which He gave them nationally at Sinai, the same time that they became a viable nation. Now, I think most people today have been deluded into thinking that God really allows them to recognize Him one day a week and ignore Him six. And that's a fallacy. People got the idea somewhere, and someday we're going to correct that, I hope. They also believe, and it's been that way for some time now, unfortunately, that God is restricted to churches and religions, and He must stay out of government and out of everyday life. I believe that the basis for most of that teaching comes from what's called the Jewish Babylonian Talmud. It doesn't come from the Bible. And, of course, Jewish Babylonian work hand in hand. And that's the difference, you see, between religion and ethics. Because the Jewish Babylonian Talmud is religious, but it's certainly not ethical. If you ever have read it, you will know that. And our Bible is not a book of religion, it's a book of ethics. It's a book of Christian ethics. Now, you may be wondering, or starting to wonder, which day, then, I think, is the real Sabbath. Well, to answer that question, I would first have to ask, what century and which nation? In other words, if somebody asked me, well, what day is the Sabbath, or what day was the Sabbath, I would have to say, or I'd have to ask, what century and which nation? Remember, Saturday or Sunday may be words and concepts in our vocabulary, but they are Roman designations for days in the Roman calendar. To trace Sabbath keeping, we have to go back beyond the Romans, don't we? Maybe you would want to ask the question, which day was the Sabbath in Judea in 10 AD? I could answer that question. Or maybe you'd want to ask, which day was the Sabbath in Babylon in 500 BC? I could answer that question. Or maybe you're actually asking, what day was the Sabbath at the time of Moses, 1450 BC? But I'd have to know which calendar to refer to before I could answer your question. Without knowing the place, the time, and the particular calendar, I can't tell you which day was their Sabbath. But I can just hear it now, because I've heard it before. Some people are going to hear this and say, well, if you can count to seven, you can tell what day is the Sabbath. Have you ever heard that? So for those of you who think that that's the answer to this, here's my answer. You can't tell which day is the Sabbath by merely counting to seven. By counting to seven, you can only tell which day is the seventh from the day that you started counting. In the case of Israel's calendar and Egypt's calendar and other similar calendars where added days and leap years and other factors were employed, counting to seven is not the ultimate answer. Sure, it'll find the Sabbath for you for a few weeks and possibly a few months, but somewhere between the time that you started and the passing of 12 months, it will go off track, almost without exception. Unless you have a system of continuous 7-day week cycles, as in our Roman calendar, which is based on the continuous 7-day cycles of the Babylonian calendar. Now, I'm not saying that days have been lost. That argument is old and beside the point, and the Seventh-day Adventists and others like that have devised an argument against that and have dispelled that idea a long time ago. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that all that is needed to change the Sabbath cycle, to change the Sabbath, as far as when it falls, is to change the method of calculating it. That's all you need. And then, over a period of months, years, and centuries, different methods of calculating the Sabbath can take the schedule completely different directions. And before long, you have various Sabbaths falling on different days. Different calendars have done that more than once. The calendar God gave to Moses had a different method of calculating than the one we have today. That means that the Sabbaths that were figured on the Roman calendar system are not the same Sabbaths that were on the old Israel calendar. By the same token, the Jewish calendar is also different, and the Sabbaths calculated on it are not the same as were on Israel's calendar. The reason I keep harping on it and harping on it, and maybe you're getting tired of me harping on it, but the reason I do that is because time after time I've seen the blank look in people's eyes when I tell them this, and they stare back at you and they wonder, well, you know, what's new? It's not even comprehensible to them. They don't seem to understand it, and they don't even seem to be interested. But I keep saying it over and over again in all the different ways I can think of, because I believe that eventually I'm going to hit sympathetic chords with some people. Now, you've learned so far that historically calendars have differed in methods of timekeeping, and I've touched upon the Egyptian, the Hebrew, the Babylonian, which is the same as the Jewish, the Roman calendars, and I've touched upon all those a small amount. There are others also that have had profound effect upon Israel. And here is the succession of calendars which have figured into Israel's history. The Akkadians in Mesopotamia had a calendar which antedated the Egyptian calendar, but that had a part to play. Then there was the Egyptian, then the one given to Moses on Sinai, then there was the Assyrian calendar, which superseded the Hebrew calendar at that time, as Israel was taken into captivity in Assyria about 800 century B.C. At that point, any lingering vestiges of Moses' calendar would have gone into extinction. Then there was the Babylonian calendar, and it was essentially very similar to the Assyrian predecessor. The Babylonian calendar was then followed by the Medo-Persian calendar, which was still fairly similar to the Assyrian and Babylonian calendar. And then that was followed by the Greek calendar, and then by the Roman calendar. Israelites passed through all of these systems before they ever got to America, didn't they? They passed through all of those systems, and more, which I haven't named. And with respect to the method of calculation, each one was a little different. Some of them quite different. Some of the calendars in the Anglo-Saxon history in Europe were considerably different. But from nation to nation, these calendars, some of them were similar, some of them were different, but they did have differences with regard to particular holidays, and that would affect the Sabbath. But for the most part, most of them did have what was called a continuous 7-day cycle week, patterned after the Babylonian week. So you can see that as our Israel people filtered through these systems, at least 6, 7, and maybe as many as 10 or 12, depending on where they went, these different societies and different calendar systems, their Sabbaths underwent changes. That's because the method of calculating the Sabbaths underwent changes. The Roman calendar, with its days of the week named after the planet gods, and the calendar which preceded it, had both been awkwardly tied in with the heresies of astrology, or in other words, star worship. And of course, that would be a religious calendar based on lunar months. You don't have to be a genius to realize that the motive behind those kind of calendars was religious instead of ethical. Moses had no such motive. and hopefully we don't either. Now, in thinking this whole scenario through, it's vital to realize that by the time our Lord Jesus appeared, the Israelite calendar had already been out of use for over 600 years. During the interim, from the captivity of Jerusalem, which is about 600 B.C., up until the time that the New Testament writings came to be, which would have been in the 1st century A.D., Moses' calendar hadn't been in use by any nation the whole time. Neither was the calendar of Samaria or Judea, the original calendar from Moses. And so we don't read too much about Moses' calendar in the writings of the New Testament, and that's the reason why we don't. At the time of Christ, Palestine was based on the Roman calendar, and the Pharisee religion was based on the Babylonian calendar. You might say that Judea had two calendars, a religious Babylonian calendar and a civil Roman calendar, and they did have two calendars. Hopefully, you're beginning to see that there were different Sabbaths for different people and different nations. Now, let's make some general comparisons here. It's well documented by hundreds of historians, almost without argument, that the state religion of both Assyria and Babylon, well before the time that Israel was ever taken into captivity in there, but including that time as well, had a mandatory seventh-day Sabbath. Now, maybe you didn't know that. But Babylonian religion was patterned after, or counterfeited after, some of the many laws that Israel had. They counterfeited them. And both Assyria and Babylon had a mandatory seventh-day Sabbath, one that almost cannot be distinguished against many of the ideas of Sabbath nowadays that you hear about in Christian theology. Very similar. Now, a Babylonian calendar was a lunar calendar, and it had 354 days to the year. And that's 12 months. One month would have 30 days, next month would have 29 days, approximately, back and forth the whole year. And you ended up with 354 days through the year, which meant that about every third year they had to have what was called an intercalary month to make up for the difference. But the reason they went through that problem is because they were so fascinated and so involved with moon worship, or the lunar cycles, which is involved in astrology, that they had to have the lunar cycles involved, and these months were based upon the moon. Another thing that they had was the Babylonian seven-day week system, which is a perpetual 7 days throughout. It never changes. And so the entire year, really, is based upon two things in the Babylonian calendar. And it was on the seven-day week, which never changed, and on the lunar months. And then they had to try to match that up with the true solar or tropical year, as it's called, which is approximately 365 and a quarter days. Now, the seventh-day Sabbath that they employed in Assyrian Babylon was not the same seventh day that fell on Moses' calendar. Now, that is to say, it wasn't just a different day of the week, but it was actually a different computation to find that day. It was found in a different manner. If we compared Moses' calendar to the Babylonian calendar, we'd find that Moses' Sabbath day would jump backward one day in the Babylonian week each year. Now, let me say that again. If we compared Moses' calendar to the Babylonian calendar, we'd find that the Sabbath of Moses would jump backward one day in the Babylonian week every year. In other words, by watching the Babylonian seven-day week, which never changes and is rigid and always stays the same, the Israel Sabbath would appear to move backward one day every year in that week. In 7 years, Moses' Sabbath would have fallen on each of the 7 days of the Babylonian week and back eventually to the same day again that it started, only 1 week earlier in the year. The main reason for this is because Moses' calendar had one annual Sabbath rest, which lasted 48 hours instead of 24 hours. In other words, two solar days back-to-back, which amounted to one Sabbath or one rest period. And this factor caused what appeared to the Babylonians as the loss of one day of their week each year. The tract that we will produce, hopefully, will have a rough chart or a type of calendar to look at and visually understand this. Most of you have never considered a fixed annual calendar system like Israel had. But you have to think about it for a while before you can appreciate it. Israel's calendar was a fixed schedule. It never deviated as to a date or a Sabbath or a month, with the exception of the leap year, in which every 4 years one Sabbath would have been added, probably near the end of the year. But other than that, it was always the same, and it didn't affect, even when they did have the leap year, it didn't affect the rest of the dates in the Sabbath. The schedule never changed from year to year. Every date, every designated Sabbath, every feast day, every anniversary would have fallen on the same date, the same day of the same Sabbath cycle, on the same month, every year, year in and year out. It was much less confusing than the Roman calendar that we operate under today. Now, for the sake of clarity, we should also go back a bit and make a quick comparison between Egypt's calendar at the time of the Exodus and Moses' calendar, remembering that Moses and the children of Israel had been using the Egyptian calendar for around 400 years. The Egypt calendar was a solar calendar, and Israel's calendar also was solar, based on the solar year, not lunar. Egypt's calendar began with the first month in the fall. Israel's calendar began with the first month in the spring. Egypt's calendar had 365 days exactly, and Israel's calendar had 365 and a quarter day, which made it more accurate. Egypt's calendar had 12 months of 30 days each, with 5 additional days added at the end of the year. Moses' calendar had 12 months of 30 days each, but he added 3 days at the end of the 6th month, and then 2 days at the end of the 12th month. That was for the purpose of keeping the Sabbath falling on the right day. Egypt's calendar had a month that was broken evenly into 3 units of 10 days. Now, that would be the counterpart to what we today call weeks. They had, if you wanted to call it a week, you would say that they had 3 10-day weeks per month. At the end of these 10-day units would be what was called a market day, or the 10th day would be a market day, which itself was in many ways comparable to the Sabbath in Israel. Now, in Israel, they had a 7-day Sabbath cycle, not a 10-day. Now, Israel also had its own holidays, including that double Sabbath, that double-day Sabbath of 48 hours. Now, to a person today, keeping one day and seven as a Sabbath, this one point needs to be emphasize perhaps more, because it's crucial to the understanding of the difference in Israel's old calendar and the system of the continuous 7-day weeks of our present calendar, which is also true of the Babylonian calendar. Looking at just that one factor, once again, let me run through it this way, because we can pinpoint this and see how that this will prevent, or would have prevented, the Sabbath of Moses consistently falling on the Sabbath or the seventh day of the Roman calendar, or the Babylonian calendar either, for that matter. The Roman adopted its system of a 7-day week from the Greeks, who got it from Babylon. The biggest difference, again, between Moses' calendar and Pope Gregory's calendar, which is the calendar that we have, is that one time every year, at the time of Pentecost, the Sabbath fell on a 2-day, 48-hour rest period. Turn to Leviticus chapter 23. This explains how to observe this Sabbath. Starting in verse 15, it talks about the feast day of Pentecost, and it says, "Ye shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete." In other words, 7 complete Sabbath cycles, 7 times 7. "Even unto the morrow after the 7th Sabbath shall ye number 50 days, and ye shall offer a new burnt offering unto the Lord." Go on over now to verse 21. And ye shall proclaim on the selfsame day, that it may be an holy convocation unto you, ye shall do no servile work therein, it shall be a statute forever in all your dwellings throughout your generations. Now, what that said was, you have seven Sabbath day cycles, which is 49 days. The 49th day was a natural Sabbath because it fell on the seventh day. And then it says that you count even to the morrow after the Sabbath, after the seventh Sabbath, shall ye number 50 days. And ye shall offer a new meat offering unto the Lord. And in verse 21, talking about the same day, it says, ye shall proclaim on that selfsame day that it may be a holy convocation. 2 days, back to back. One Sabbath, 2 days. One rest period. In other words, the Sabbath cycle that led up to this would be normal. It would, you know, you would have first day, second day, third day, fourth day. By the way, they didn't have names for their days. They just counted them. Fifth day, sixth day. And then the seventh day would begin the regular Sabbath. In this case, it would begin the Sabbath of Pentecost, which was the end of counting to 49 days from the offering of the first fruit. So you would have a Sabbath then, and then you would have the next day, part of the same Sabbath, 48 hours, and then the following day would start with day one again. And then you would go and have a regular seven-day cycle again, which would continue unbroken until you came again to Pentecost the next year, and then it would be broken again. Now, in terms of our weekly calendar today, what that would mean is that, again, this Sabbath would fall backward one day in the week every year. If it started on Saturday this year, it would be Sunday next year after Pentecost. If it was Sunday then, the next year after Pentecost, it would be Monday if we compared it to our calendar. And eventually it would fall on every day of the week. Now, that was a hard thing to get straight in my mind. I hope I've explained it where you can understand it. A corollary to this same thing concerning Pentecost is found in Leviticus 25, and we've read part of it already. It's concerning the year of Jubilee. And let's go through this because this is an interesting witness. We found that this calculation applied to Sabbaths of days. Here in Leviticus 25, it speaks about the Sabbaths of years and the 50th year Jubilee Sabbath. Reading from verse 8 again, it says, and ye shall number seven Sabbaths of years unto thee. 7 times 7 years, and the space of 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto thee 49 years. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, in the Day of Atonement, shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. And ye shall hallow the 50th year, and proclaim liberty throughout all the land and all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a Jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man into his possession, and ye shall return every man into his family. The law of the Jubilee, of course, is a very interesting subject which needs more than what I can give it here. You should study that on your own. A very interesting and important part of the calendar. Notice also now, over in verse 18, that we have here a time period spoken of 3 years. And I want you to notice how this 3 years comes into play, because it substantiates my claim about the two-day Sabbath at Pentecost. Starting in verse 18, wherefore ye shall do my statutes and keep my judgments and do them, and ye shall dwell in the land in safety, and the land shall yield her fruit, and ye shall eat your fill and dwell therein in safety. And if ye shall say, what shall we eat the 7th year? Behold, we shall not sow nor gather in our increase. Now, this is a natural question. The first thing that you think of, well, if somebody says, well, the 7th year, you let your land lie dormant. You let it rest. And the first thing they say is, oh, I'd go broke. The banks would foreclose. Of course, this was written before, you know, the banks had title to our property. But that's the first question. And, of course, here's the answer. Notice the answer. He said, what shall I do? Because I can't sow nor gather in any of our increase. Then I will command my blessing upon you in the 6th year, and it shall bring forth fruit for 3 years. In other words, he's saying that in the 6 years, which go up to the seventh year, you will be blessed to the point where you will have an increase which will last 3 years. Now, why 3 years? Why not just 1 year? Well, this is talking, remember, about the year of Jubilee. And I told you that the year of Jubilee is the counterpart in terms of years to the Feast of Pentecost in terms of days. In both cases, you have two Sabbaths. So a year of Jubilee, the land lies dormant 2 years. But he says 3 years here. Why 3 years? It says, and ye shall sow the eighth year, and eat yet of the old fruit until the ninth year, until her fruits come in, ye shall eat of the old store. Now, what he said here is, he uses the term eighth year and ninth year. The 49th year is a Sabbath. That would have been the seventh year in a seven-year cycle. The 50th year is a Sabbath. That would have been the eighth year in a Sabbath cycle. And the ninth year then was needed to grow the crop that had just been sowed. So you actually had three growing seasons where you didn't have any of your increase gathered in. So you had to have goods laid up at the end of 6 years to last 3 years, three growing seasons. I think that proves, without a doubt, that there is definitely such a thing as this double-day Sabbath rest period. I don't think there's any way you can get around it. Okay, that's where I'll have to stop. Next week, I am going to get into the New Testament and finish this study, God willing, and show you what some of the writers of the New Testament said about the Sabbath. I think you're going to be surprised. Let's end. Lord God of Israel, the God of the law, the God who created the law, and of course we recognize you as our God who gave us the law. We thank you for it. We thank you for your love, the motives behind giving us this truth. We ask that somehow these people who hear these things and have access to your law will learn to love it, to understand that you gave it to us for our own good, to understand more about this Sabbath law and the importance of it, and how to apply it to our nation and our national economic standards and laws. We ask that these things could be once again established in this land, that these people may be free and economically secure and be able to rejoice in you and in your law. We thank you for these things, and we ask that they would just be brought to our attention in such a way that we can't ignore them. Help us to say things right. Help us to be accurate. Help us to preach your word in truth. In Jesus we pray. Amen.